Individuals upon the upper mental plane may therefore be divided into two types, those who are in possession of the great abstract principles of this plane and are aiming at their application to denser forms of existence, and, conscious of their source in the divine, are anxious to pass on down the stages of evolution bearing the divine light with them, and the other type, which, conscious of its goal in the divine, is ever anxious to synthesize all experience into spiritual types. The one is a diffuser, the other a unifier, the one functions with a male action, the other with a female action. What will be the expression of these two types in actual life? The one will be a philosopher, enunciating general principles, and from them inferring their consequences, and the other will be a scientist, collecting masses of data and deducing general laws from his observations. Of course, in actual practice, each thinker should employ both methods. Were he merely a collector of facts, though such exist, or were he merely an enunciator of unverified principles, and such exist also, though modern education tends to stamp them out, he would achieve little eminence in the world of thought. Our greatest contributions to human knowledge have been made by the philosophic scientist or the scientific philosopher. In general practice, however, one type of mind collects the data and another type philosophizes upon that data, and only in the most eminent do the two activities work together. In this cooperation, the esoteric philosopher sees the activity of the two types of polarity, the male induction and the female deduction, and would declare that these two methods of activity are as necessary for creation upon the plane of abstract thought as upon the plane of dense matter, the one without the other being sterile, whereas the two functioning together bear the fruit of new knowledge. Upon the fourth plane, the plane of concrete mind, the principle of polarity again applies. How weary and difficult is intellectual work performed in solitude without appreciation or sympathy, but mind responds to mind with renewed stimulation and activity when there is a mutual fund of knowledge. All brain workers know well the sudden bound forward of inspired effort after a conversation, a correspondence, or even the reading of a book upon the subject in which they are interested. The stimulative reaction of one upon another can be very clearly seen upon this plane. And whether they understand its implications or not, brain workers know it well by experience and make great use of it, as can be observed in the records of their lives. The esotericist likewise knows this principle and avails himself of it. Indeed, for certain types of work he has to wait for his counterpart, and cannot proceed alone. See, the astral planes. The planes of the emotions and passions are known to esoteric science as the upper and lower astral respectively, and here we can trace the beginnings of sex as it is ordinarily understood. Upon the third plane or upper astral, the plane of the tender affections, we see the emotional side of the nature desiring an object for the expression of its feelings or the fulfilling of its needs, and these two aspects of feeling the esotericist would regard as emotion in polarity. Upon the third plane there is still no fixity of sex, the mode of functioning determines whether the force in question is positive or negative, of male or a female type. That which has a need of emotional expression is regarded as male, and that which has a need of emotional satisfaction is regarded as female. These modes of functioning, however, can occur in rapid sequence, or even simultaneously in respect of different aspects of the nature, and the polarity is therefore constantly fluctuating. This fluctuation of polarity upon the upper astral is a very important factor in the practical application of these principles to human affairs. Upon the lower astral or plane of the instincts, polarity tends to become more stable, because this plane is very closely linked to the physical, and its conditions are influenced by the physiological phases of the body. But strange as it may appear at first sight, the sex of the second plane body is the opposite of that of the physical body. It is not difficult, however, to give the reader evidence of the truth of this statement. It is well known that a woman's love is steady, enduring, but of less intensity than a man's, whereas he reacts violently to a stimulus, and reverts to a passive condition when the stimulus is withdrawn. In this the esotericist would see the steady flow of force through the positive male vehicle of the woman, and the sudden explosion of latent energy in the female desire vehicle of a man under the stimulus of a kinetic force. Upon this plane certain kinds of magic are worked in which sex force is made use of. Hence one danger of ignorant trafficking in unknown quantities and the need of great self-control on the part of those who embark upon such occult studies. Anyone who is acquainted with those circles in which the study of practical occultism is cultivated knows that there is constant trouble in this respect unless a high moral standard is maintained. Chapter 12. Polarity upon the physical plane. We are equipped with physical bodies in which the configuration of the generative organs determines the part we shall play in the polarity of life. We are born male or female and have to abide by the decision of our conception. The phenomena of the hermaphrodite and homosexual being regarded as pathological by the esoteric as well as the exoteric scientist. The control of sexual activity upon the physical plane is determined by the chemistry of the endocrine organs, the ductless glands that pour into the blood secretions known as hormones, which, circulating in the bloodstream, stimulate the secretory organs to activity. Thus the sex pressure rises and falls in an individual according to the chemical composition of his blood, which is constantly fluctuating within certain limits. Charts have been worked out to prove this. The monthly cycle of a woman's sex life has been shown to coincide with the percentage of lime salts in her blood, and in the male also there is a rhythmic rise and fall of desire which, however, has been less studied than the more marked periodicity of the female. It has been declared by certain popular writers that in this discovery we have the clue to the whole of life, emotional, intellectual, and spiritual. It has even been stated that a man is simply the synthesis of his endocrines, and that every spiritual impulse, every emotional ideal, can be expressed in terms of lime salts. One point, however, is ignored by these philosophers of the physiological, and that is the profound influence on the endocrine organs of emotional states. One school of physiology declares that the adrenal glands situated over the kidneys are the controllers of the sex functions, another school calls the adrenals the organs of combat, as it is their secretion which tenses all the tissues to readiness for violent exertion and causes the blood to clot freely if wounds should be inflicted, and it is known that these organs are stimulated to activity when their owner feels the emotion of anger or fear. It will thus be seen that exoteric science is proving experimentally what esoteric science has long taught, that the functioning of the physical organism is controlled from the plane of the instincts and passions. Although the chemistry of the endocrines controls the functioning of the physical tissues, the endocrines are themselves controlled by the emotions. There is no need, in a book of this nature, to go into the well-known details of sexual physiology. Enough has merely been said to indicate the point where exoteric meets esoteric science, that point being the endocrine system. Chapter 13. Polarity within the organism. In the foregoing chapters, the facts of polarity between units of opposite types functioning upon the different planes has been briefly explained. There is, however, a secondary type of polarity known to esoteric science that occurs within the individual itself. The several bodies or principles of man are relatively positive and negative in their relations to each other, the more subtle being positive in its relation to the more dense. Thus, the psychic body, the body of instincts and passions, is positive towards the negative physical body, stimulates it to activity and determines its conditions, subject, of course, to the laws of physics and chemistry that control the material plane. Each body in the series, then, is controlled by the one above it, and has to await the stimulus of this subtler body before it can function. Likewise, it acts as controller to, and stimulator of, the body below it in the line of manifestation. It is therefore male in relation to its denser vehicle and female in relation to the subtler matter that ensouls itself. The seventh plane monad or spark of spiritual life is the prime determinant of the whole septenary. It gives life and individualization, without which there would be no unit at all. The sixth plane ray conditions determine type, and the fifth plane abstract qualities, in combination with the ray type, determine the individualized nature of fundamental traits. From the fourth plane downwards, the personality is built up by means of experience, for it is upon the fourth plane of the concrete mind that memory begins. The individuality of the three upper planes, however, entirely determines the original direction of the path pursued in evolution. Whatever modifications may occur as the result of circumstances, the individual will always tend to revert to its original line of advance as soon as opposition is removed. The memories collected in the concrete mind naturally determine the emotional reactions an individual makes to his environment upon the third plane, and his feelings will equally determine the goals of his instinctive activities upon the second plane, making him seek that which is pleasant and avoid that which is unpleasant. The first plane, as we have already seen, is regulated by the emotions playing upon the endocrines and the impulses given to the nervous system. We may then say, to sum up, that each body is governed by the laws of its own plane, and that its functionings are regulated by the body of the plane immediately above its own. Thus, the physical body being controlled by the psychic body, we should seek to influence that body if the control of the physical machinery should go amiss. This we do from the third plane, which is the plane of picture consciousness, by causing it to dwell upon images of health and perfect functioning. These pictures, if they arise with sufficient clearness and persistency in the picture consciousness of the third plane, will pull the second plane body into line, and cause it to send corresponding impulses to the dense vehicle, which, as soon as the poisonous chemical combinations arising from faulty functioning can be expelled from the system, and provided no organic change has taken place, will then revert to conditions of health. This remedial process has been popularized by the system known as autosuggestion, and a more elaborate and far-reaching application of it has been made by Christian Science, wherein the fifth plane aspect of the mind is induced to dwell upon abstract principles of harmony and control assumed from that plane. When true spiritual healing occurs, as contrasted with so-called spiritual healing arising from the autosuggestion of religious faith, it takes place from the seventh plane itself, the monad assuming control of all bodies below it and determining their conditions, an exceedingly rare occurrence. In the ordinary course of nature, the mutual control of the series of vehicles goes steadily on, but the man who wishes to raise the forces of any particular body to a high potentiality, can deliberately avail himself of it. Supposing the man we are considering is a creative artist, he can raise the potentiality of his astral body, for it is upon the third plane that the imaginative arts are carried on, by bringing to bear upon it his intellect in addition to his imagination. He will find that the application of the concrete mind to the problem of a half-visualized work will cause his emotion to concrete itself into an artistic form, a concretion that would not have taken place had nothing beyond the emotional forces of the third plane fired him. Equally, upon the fourth, or plane of concrete thought, he must bring into function his power of abstract mentation if he is to see the implication of the facts he is considering. Abstract thought must derive its stimulus from spirit itself. This action and reaction between two of a man's vehicles, which is necessary for creative work, for that externalizing of the force within an individual by providing for it a vehicle in the matter of one or other of the planes, whether the vehicle be in the form of the written word upon the mental plane, or of sound or color upon the astral, would be regarded by the esoteric scientist as an example of the everlasting principle of polarity underlying all creative functioning. A reverse flow of the current, however, is sometimes achieved. A man may seek to stimulate a particular vehicle by means of the one below instead of the one above. Thus, he may cause his concrete mind to throw his abstract mind into a state of activity. In this case, we get the man who uses abstract principles in the service of particular instances, who demands that the laws of the universe shall fall in with his standards of right and wrong, who reads his own interpretations into the utterances of minds greater than his own and then presents them as justifications of his views. He is omniscided, bigoted, unamenable to argument, and unable to see any other side of the case than that which he has predetermined. Thus the nature of the lower plane limits the inspiration available through contact with the higher. Equally, the man whose emotions prompt him to intellectual work is inclined to seek to prove a case rather than to discover the truth, and where the emotions are controlled by the appetites rather than the reason, we have the unstable, inconstant, violent individual, i.e. all things by turns, and nothing longer the sentimentalist, lacking the driving force and intelligence necessary to give effect to his dreams. When the instincts are controlled by the physical sensations rather than the tender affections which should humanize them into love, we have the sensualist, cruel or voluptuous as his passions fluctuate with his endocrines. Alcohol is one of the most potent factors in reversing the polarity of the bodies. Absorbed by the physical body, it speeds up the vital processes till the dense vehicle is more actively energized than the subtle bodies, and therefore becomes positive in its relations to them, and capable of giving the stimulus that sets them creating. When, however, the urge of the alcohol slackens, there is a period of slack water as the flow of the vital current comes to a stop before it can reverse its motion and resume its natural course. This constitutes one aspect of the reaction well known to follow upon the use of alcohol. Chapter 14, Polarity Within a Group. Modern science is beginning to realize that the psychology of a crowd does not merely consist of the sum total of the natures of the people forming it. Esoteric science has long known this truth, and made great use of it in its work. Ritual draws a large measure of its power from the fact that it focuses a group and draws upon the powers of the group mind. The theory of the group mind, though well known to occultists, is but little familiar even to psychologists who have not studied this line of thought. Therefore, a brief outline must be given in order to render plain its special application to the subject of this book. Let me say, however, for those who are familiar already with the esoteric concepts in their exoteric form, that a group mind is not the same thing as a group soul. A certain portion of the subconscious mind is not walled up within the personality. When a number of people have their attention focused upon the same object and feel towards this object the same emotion, as when a congregation's attention is concentrated upon a preacher with either love and admiration or resentment and hate, the free-floating portions of its subconsciousness tend to flow together and amalgamate in a single cloud which overshadows the whole group. It must be clearly understood that metaphorical language is employed. The composite mind thus formed will contain only those ideas and feelings which are directed towards the common object of attention. These ideas will diffuse themselves throughout its substance and so find their way into the subconscious minds of all the people composing the group, and thence will influence their conscious minds. Hence the importance of a careful selection of membership in any closely organized group, for a single dominant personality can tinge the whole. When a group mind has become well established, it has a distinct personality of its own. It is a separate entity, drawing its life from the group that brought it into being. It can be altered by any alteration in the spirit of the group, but it can only be destroyed by dispersing the group, so that, should an undesirable tone make itself felt in an association of persons, the only remedy is to disband, and after an interval start afresh. This group mind, as soon as it is sufficiently developed, affiliates itself to those natural forces to which it is most nearly akin. For instance, a philanthropic group mind will draw upon the spiritual forces of the faith that inspires it, and a patriotic one upon the group soul of the race. Therefore, although individuals will find that their energies are drawn upon when they are engaged in building up a group mind, they will find that when once it is built, it becomes a source of energy for them to draw upon in their turn. A concrete example will serve to make this somewhat difficult and unfamiliar concept clear. Let us imagine a man with a spiritual message to deliver. By great effort he succeeds in gathering around himself a little band of believers. As soon as he has accomplished this, he finds that his work has become much easier. He preaches with much greater force and influence, and less effort, his inspiration becomes stronger and less spasmodic. Disharmony or indifference among his group will affect him very closely. Any minister of religion will confirm this from his experience of the deadweight of an inert congregation and the inspiration of an enthusiastic one. Those most prominent in the work of the church will be very definitely aware of the backing and momentum of the group mind established by a common interest and enthusiasm. It acts as a psychic flywheel to carry them over the dead center of personal shortcomings. To these people, the group soul acts as a male force, stimulating them in their creative activities and protecting them from external influences and antagonism. In the case of the rank and file, however, the position is reversed. The group soul draws upon them, but by drawing their life forces from them it sets up a spiritual suction, as it were, and fresh life forces enter them from the universal life. One of the principal causes of trouble in unmated women is the stagnation and staleness of their unused life forces. The group mind, by calling upon these, prevents this stagnation and puts them in circuit. It will invariably be observed that a religious or philanthropic movement draws a very large portion of its power from the unmated women who flock about it, because it supplies them with an outlet for their energies. These women pour into the group mind those energies which would have been spent in love and care for husband and children had they been mated. Thus the work of civilization gets done, the group soul of the race absorbing the energies of a large number of women into itself. It may be observed that the tendency of all highly evolved civilizations is to produce a superfluity of women, more than can be absorbed in the task of reproduction. These women are produced of deliberate purpose, because they are wanted for the group work by means of which the higher phases of evolution are brought into manifestation. By knowledge of this fact, and deliberate use of its possibilities, the unmated woman can find her place in the world, feel her idle energies being drawn upon, and herself caught into the great stream of psychic race life, which is such a potent source of inspiration and satisfaction to those who are taking part in its flow. A group mind, then, has two aspects. It is a reservoir of force upon which the leaders of the group draw for their creative work, and it is an outlet for the unused and wasted energies of its rank and file. A knowledge of this fact offers a valuable contribution to the solution of the problem of our superfluous womanhood. Chapter 15. The Ideal Marriage. Seldom is the ideal marriage seen, and yet each human being who enters upon that state does so in the hope that it will yield him the highest earthly happiness. Intuitively he knows that only in union with another being of an opposite polarity to himself can the full possibilities of human evolution be realized. And in the hope of attaining the highest evolution of which he is capable, he embarks upon a life of interaction with one of the opposite sex. He stakes all upon a single venture, and seldom obtains thereby his soul's desire. Many marriages rest upon no other basis than mutual toleration. Many couples are only held together by the pressure of public opinion. Some are bound to each other by no higher bond than mutual convenience. And yet each of them was led into the married state by the sense of a need which only union with another could fulfill. This, then, is at the base of desire for union a need, whether for the expression of an overflowing pressure of life or the reception of a force lacking to the nature, and only that union fulfills its purpose in which these needs are met, in which each of the pair finds in the other a demand for that which he craves to give, and a fulfillment of his own desires. There has to be an interchange which takes from each his painful superfluity and uses it to supply the other with that which he lacks. If this consummation upon all points be not achieved, then the craving for union will continue as an unsatisfied and tormenting hunger, on will turn elsewhere for its satisfaction, involving misery and social disorder. The alienation may be partial or total. The individual as a whole may withdraw from his or her mate and seek another in an unlegalized union with all its dire consequences, or he may turn away with but a part of his nature, seeking intellectual companionship and emotional sympathy alone, and refraining from that act of physical union which popular thought alone recognizes as a sexual act. It would, however, be rash to say that a man is any less male in his relations with a woman because he represses his desires towards her and contents himself with intellectual companionship alone. Jesus says that whosoever looketh upon a woman to lust after her hath already committed adultery with her in his heart, and those who have insight into human nature know that they have more cause to be jealous of the loyalty of the mind than of the body, A wife has little cause for pride in a tribute of the physical instincts which could be paid to any comely female of the species, if the deep yearning of the higher man in the being she has married turns elsewhere. It is the woman who is the object of an illicit love who truly holds the man rather than she who shares his name and bed. Our laws and theology, however, with a short-sighted policy, reckon of nothing but physical fidelity and ignore the lust of the eye, thereby building for us whited sepulchres full of all uncleanness. The laws of mating, as understood by esoteric philosophy, embrace much more than mere physical union, recognizing, as they do, the seven bodies of man and sex, or polarity, upon each of the seven planes according to their several conditions. Esoteric philosophy teaches, therefore, that unless a man mate each of his bodies which has arrived at a functionable state, his union will be incomplete, and he will still be in a state of sex hunger, seeking his mate. All men, however, are not equally evolved. In the average man at the present day, only the first three bodies are capable of mating: the physical vehicle, the body of the instincts, and the body of the emotions. That is to say, he is capable of physical congress, of instinctive desire, and of tender affection for his mate, but has little conception of intellectual companionship. A more evolved man, however, will have this latter ideal if his mental body be in function, and will seek for his wife one with like interests to his own. A more primitive type, on the other hand, will demand of his mate nothing but a gratification of his senses, and will be quite indifferent to her when his passions are satiated. Thus it will be seen that if a man who has three bodies in function and is capable of the tender affections marries a woman who has but two in function and has no concept of married life beyond passion and physical gratification, disaster will occur. Or should he, having four bodies in function, marry a woman who can only love and is not capable of being a companion to him, sorrow will also occur. The woman will derive from her husband all that she requires, for she is functioning up to her full three-plane capacity, but he will have an unmated mental body which will assuredly seek a mate, and possibly find it in an intellectual woman capable of functioning upon the fourth plane, and then will be seen one of those platonic friendships of which everyone is instinctively suspicious, but which no one can convict of any offense against the laws of morality. It will be found that no matter how loyal a man may be in will and action towards his wife, a union upon the higher plane will tend to divert the flow of the life current so that it short circuits across the fourth plane. Instead of passing down the vehicles of that man, till by means of the generative organs it be returned to the divine through the completion of the circuit in the act of physical union with his wife, it will flow to his intellectual companion in the form of intellectual force. His feelings towards his wife will become as empty as the bed of a stream below the closed sluice gates that have turned the water into another course. It will remain to be seen whether the morality of the platonic friends can avail to keep the current in its appointed channel, or whether they will be shaken out of their platonism under the pressure of the life of the universe seeking expression. If their morality give way, the life forces will break bounds, and, following the line of their natural flow, run down the emotional and passional vehicles till they reach the physical. Then, and not till then, will what is legally known as misconduct at last be committed. Let us now consider the case of a highly evolved man who is preparing to mate, and lay down the ideal conditions for such a union. First, he will have to remember that his different bodies reach maturity at different ages. The physical body is complete in all its parts at birth. The desire body does not come into function till puberty, which, indeed, marks the completion of the desire body. The tender affections develop during the teens, and the concrete mental body during the twenties. A strict septenary reckoning is employed by some schools of esoteric science. But individuals vary in their development, and the foregoing rough division will serve. The abstract mind develops during the thirties, and the spiritual nature will not have reached its full unfoldment till the late forties. Therefore, the highly evolved individual should delay his mating till well on in life, when it can be seen which way his evolution is trending. Many people, unfortunately, are hurried into a permanent mating by the activities of the desire body, and resort to marriage with the first available person of the opposite sex as the only means of obtaining relief from gnawing desires. Other hasty people mistake emotional surging for their rapport of true union, not yet realizing the capacities of their own nature, which may continue to develop after marriage. Well is it for a married pair if their growth be even and simultaneous. They will find in married life the deepening and enriching of their love as body after body comes into function and meets its mate within the home that is reaching up to heaven. If, on the contrary, one has reached full stature while the other is still capable of growth, the marriage which started happily will end in compromise or failure, since the more highly evolved of the two will be conscious of needs which the other cannot comprehend or satisfy. In perfect marriage, however, the same pair mate with each higher body as it comes into function, experiencing with each mating new depths of love.